students advancing after failing the reading test, a judge rules for John Rust in his bid to get on the ballot, plus recommendations to weaken agency rulemaking, and more. From the television studios at WFYI, it's Indiana Week in Review, for the week ending December 8th, 2023.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, the Indiana Department of Education says too many third graders who fail a statewide reading test are advancing to fourth grade. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Kirsten Adair reports the IDOE is working on a new data visualization tool that shows where students are struggling the most.
Nearly one in five third graders in Indiana lack key literacy skills, and state education officials say average scores for the state's reading test, the iRead 3, are declining. Data from the IDOE shows that over the past few years, more than 96% of third graders who failed iRead 3 advanced to fourth grade. Secretary of Education Katie Jenner says not passing iRead 3 has a profound impact on students' education.
If a child moves forward not passing iRead 3, they will likely never pass iLearn.
The IDOE previewed a tool officials say will help educators and lawmakers track progress as the state works to boost reading scores. It includes a map that shows iRead 3 trends and tracks how many students progress to fourth grade after failing the test. Jenner says the tool will soon be available to educators and parents.
Should the state hold more students back when they fail the iRead test? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Elise Schrock. Republican Mike O'Brien. Oshia Boyd, editor-in-chief of Mirror Indy, and Nikki Kelly, editor-in-chief of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Elise, before I get to you, congratulations to you, Oshia, and Mirror Indy for your launch this week.
Yes, thank you.
We are all excited to see the stuff you already have rolling out and what's to come.
Thank you.
So, Elise, is Indiana advancing too many kids?
Well, I think that's something we seriously need to look at, but we have to look at the whole scope of what's happening here with reading rates. I think everyone can agree that reading is essential to creating good leaders. And that's why we saw legislation, major bipartisan legislation, last year to try to align some new trainings for third grade reading levels, the science in reading. So we're going to need to wait to see the impact that that has. We're going to need to look at when the public data is released publicly on the dashboard. So it's definitely something that is shocking enough to be paying attention to, but to be fair, I think leaders from all sides are doing that.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have a lot from legislative leaders on what they'll actually do this session, but this is one this is the top of everybody's list, it seems.
Yep.
This and truancy. So is that a difficult political conversation to have when you're going to tell parents, sorry, we're holding your kid back?
Yeah, I think part of this is stigma. Holding a kid back, right? And that's a problem. There's a bigger stigma assigned to not getting a high school diploma, which is what's likely to happen if you can't read in third grade.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we need, totally agreed. We need to look at the whole picture. You also need to start rolling in, okay, what is happening before third grade? Revisit pre-K, mm-hmm. And prioritize in those areas. Maybe that's how we revisit the pre-K conversation. We prioritize using this data on where this is happening the most, those areas that need the most investment, and target the areas where kids are most likely to not be able to pass iRead.
Elise brought up the fact that Indiana did do big things last session with the science of reading. I think it was a couple of different bills mm-hmm. on the science of reading, really trying to make it so that we're teaching kids the way they need to be taught to make this as effective as possible. Those had barely taken effect. And Todd Houston, Speaker Todd Houston, talked about part of the reason he wants to be more limited this session is Indiana just did a whole bunch of big things in the last couple of years. Let's give them time to roll out. Why do we not see the same sort of let's wait and see how things take effect on reading proficiency?
Well, can we wait and see? I mean, we kind of don't have time. The kids who are in third grade now will move on. So we need to know what's happening now and trying to fix it now. But I do think we need to take a holistic approach from pre-K, which, by the way, we had an On My Way pre-K story on launch day. So so from pre-K on, because we know what happens in third grade has an effect for the rest of their school lives. And what happens there usually determines what's going to happen in high school and beyond. So we need to make sure that what is happening in third grade. Stigma, yes, no one wants to flunk. That was the thing when I was growing up, kids flunked. they stop that because of the stigma. But to the point of not having a diploma, not having a good job, these are all the things that we need to be thinking about in third grade with reading now. And I think it does start in pre-K. We've been kind of reluctant to go back, all the way back. It was glorified daycare. We had that with full-day kindergarten. Now we're glorified daycare pre-K. But these things are very vital for the long term. And we need to start thinking about these things now.
We also got to On My Way Pre-K because we started with Mitch Daniels and Tony Bennett talking about this 15 years ago. And here we are.
I mean, stigma is real. And that's going to be a problem because going back to when they created the reading test, the original plan was let's hold a lot more kids back. And then these exceptions piled up and piled up and piled up because they're unpopular.
Well, I'll tell you what. I mean, they'd mentioned a lot, Speaker Houston and Senate President Pro Tem Bray mentioned the exceptions. I was more concerned, and there were like, in just numbers for people, not just percentages, there were like 5,500 exceptions. Yep. There were about a little less than 14,000 kids who failed it. I'm more concerned about the 8,300 people who didn't get an exception and moved on. We only held back 400 kids across the entire state who failed. So, I mean, I think that's the bigger discussion. And I do want to note that as someone we've mentioned, obviously, pre-K, like what are we doing before third grade? We still are, I think, the only state that doesn't require kids to go to school until they're seven. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, could that maybe be having something to do with
that? Well, just announced, you know, they're going to be rolling out another one of those bills. Like, they just announced that in their legislative agenda last week.
Yeah, Greg Taylor, the leader of the Senate Democrats, I mean, he's been talking about that for, it feels like, a decade.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's
one of his biggest problems.
And one thing I hope the visualization tool helps is, I do think it would be helpful to know of the thousands of kids failing. Are they failing by one percentage point? Mm-hmm, are they failing by 30 percentage points?
Like, there's a big
correct.
So you can move on, but there's a plan. There's
exactly. Yes.
Let me ask you this before we move on. If you're going to really hold, I mean, maybe it isn't a legislative solution. Maybe it really is just applying the law as it is now and not allowing kids to advance if they're failing the test. But either way, if that's ultimately what happens here, at least in the short term, are we looking at a major bottleneck problem in third grades across the state?
Yeah, which is why we probably do need to be looking at that compulsory aid and entry age legislation, because if you don't have to go in until you're seven and then you're in third grade, you know, the rate at which kids are starting, even between pre-K and third grade, that is going to create a bottleneck.
Well, and that could be why they've been passed on to fourth grade anyway, and going and getting remediation back in third grade but still moving to fourth grade, because it will create a bottleneck. You have to think about individual schools and what their needs are.
I started school in Illinois, and so I was actually younger than the oldest kids in the grade behind me when I came to Indiana. Mm. So I would have been like the youngest kid in the grade behind me. Because I started so early in Illinois. I started when I was like 3 or 4 years old.
Yeah, same here. All right, time
now
for time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question. And this week's question is, should more students be held back if they don't pass the third grade reading proficiency test? A, yes, or B, no? Really interested to find out what people think about that one. Last week's question was, can Democrat Destiny Wells defeat Attorney General Todd Rokita in next year's election? 75% of you say yes, 25% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Indiana Republican Congressman Jim Banks might have an opponent on the ballot for next year's U.S. Senate primary after all. That's because a judge ruled in favor of Southern Indiana egg farmer John Rust this week in a lawsuit challenging the state's ballot access law. There are two ways an Indiana candidate can run in a Republican or Democratic primary. They must have voted in that party's primary in the last two primary elections in which they cast a ballot, or they have to get the permission of the county party leader where they live. John Rust doesn't meet those requirements. He voted in the 2016 GOP primary, but cast Democratic ballots before that, and his local party leader refuses to allow him access.
Rust sued, and Marion County Judge Patrick Dietrich ruled in his favor. Dietrich writes that while the Supreme Court has acknowledged the right of political parties to decide their own members, the election itself is run and financed by the state, and so the ballot access law must serve the citizens' interests, not just the political parties. And Dietrich writes, there is no compelling or even rational government interest being served here.
Mike O'Brien, an appealing of this really is, I mean, possible, even likely, I would say. And even if ultimately it's upheld, John Russ still has to get signatures from 500 registered voters in each of the state's 9 congressional districts, so that's a total of 4,500, in order to appear on the ballot. So with all of that said, does Jim Banks have any reason to worry?
No, not in an election. This is going to be a drubbing, I think, as has been described. I'm actually for, having been a county chairman and a district chairman, and having used this law to disqualify people from the ballot or permit people to run who didn't have a voting history, I'm actually okay revisiting these rules. But you still have to qualify for your party somehow. Other states, you know, people like to say I'm a registered Republican, I'm a registered Democrat. Not in Indiana, you're not. But in some states you are. Some states you are registered to vote. You declare your party, and that's how you become a member of that, a voting member of that party. There's got to be a way to do that. And you do need some kind of integrity in that system, because the parties do run the primaries. They're based on political outcomes in the county, determines how election boards are formed, and what majority of which party controls those majorities. There are party mechanisms in the administration of an election that are necessary, or that are important, because otherwise, what are you doing? Everybody's running for everything. And in a county like Hendricks County, where I was chairman, or Marion County, that's controlled by Democrats, candidates know how they can win. And if you're a Democrat in parts of Hendricks County, you know you can't win, so you run as a Republican, but you have a total Democrat voting history. I didn't allow that as a Republican county chairman. I don't think I should have. Yeah. But I'm for taking another look at these ballot access requirements and looking at what other states do.
Yeah, I mean, is there a better system out there? I mean, I think we like in Indiana that you don't have to declare a party, that you can vote in whatever primary you choose, because sometimes there are reasons where you might not want to vote. I mean, there's nobody on the ballot in the Republican primary, so I'll vote in the Democratic one for candidates I like or don't like. Is there a better way to do this in Indiana?
Well, I'm not sure if there I'm sure there is a better way. I think what's important here is that we're looking at different options. This is kind of fascinating to me. On numerous levels, it's fascinating from a legal standpoint. It is fascinating from an election standpoint, and also from a campaign finance standpoint, because, you know, a lot of what we're asking is, can you get the signatures as well? And you can if you pay for them. Like, that is one way to get a lot
and
of signatures.
Pay people don't collect them.
To pay
don't
people.
Literally, don't yeah, literally pay for signatures.
That's illegal.
You pay people to go and stand outside of grocery stores, outside of popular areas. Yeah. And that's how you get those signatures. If a candidate has a lot of money and can do that and can make up the time before the February deadline, we're about to see if that can happen. But so there are just so many fascinating.
A judge changing the rules 30 days before the filing period opens, I think, is inappropriate. I think if the legislature wants to look at this, that's the right place to have this debate. It wasn't in court.
Well, this is not the first challenge to this particular requirement since it came in. They expanded this from one primary. You needed only one primary. The last primary you voted in had to be for the party you want to run for, to two primaries, which is what a lot more people seem to have a problem with.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see the legislature revisiting this at all?
I mean, they might have to, but I just want some sort of explanation. And we did see a big change from the one to two. And so I never fully understood why we're doing the two. You know, should we look at donations? Because if you look at donations, he's never given to Democrat candidates. He's only given to Republicans. Similarly, Brad Chambers, who's running for Republican, has only voted Republican but has given to Democrats. So, I mean, there are a bunch of different things.
And also, but, I mean, do you really want to have donation history
right.
be what determines your political party
yeah,
membership?
That can
because
get
then
dicey.
You're, I mean, you're literally paying to, you know, enter.
They're mainly kind of, this is a little tenuous for lawmakers, is that when you look at the younger people who are turning 18 and the rules in the Constitution about where you live and what age you can run for House and Senate, stuff like that. By having this two primary rule, you're basically overruling the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a big problem, I think, than than the example of John Rust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've been curious. We haven't talked about it before now, but I want to talk about it briefly here now, which is before this ruling, and it still might get overturned, Jim Banks and his folks were hitting John Rust real hard on social media, and they have every right to do that. I'm not suggesting they're wrong to do that, but I've been curious about why. And even with this ruling, why are they going hard, so hard after John Rust?
That's a curious question. Maybe they were nervous. Maybe they already had a feeling. And maybe they don't want him to get the 500 votes in the districts.
Or
you know,
signatures, yeah.
Yeah, the signatures. So, because I wouldn't think that they will really give him much attention or time, since we pretty much already know what the outcome is going to be.
He stayed a solid lead by staying in a solid lead.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, or maybe it's just something to do. You know, I don't have anything else to do.
I actually wrote about this whole thing today for an editorial. Some people do better having an opponent to go after, and maybe that's
a little tension.
Yeah. All right. A legislative task force recently approved, along party lines, recommendations that would further restrict the ability of state agencies to adopt rules and regulations. Democrats on the task force said that while they agreed with the majority of the 12 recommendations, three of them needed further study. Chief among the complaints was a recommendation that the General Assembly create a law that would block agency rules from taking effect without legislative approval if those rules have a significant fiscal or regulatory impact. Democratic Representative Ed Delaney says that creates a separation of powers problem.
I'm not interested in issuing regulations. I don't think it's my duty. And I think also, by the way, you're pushing us in the direction of a full-time legislature.
Republican Senator Chris Garton, the chair of the task force, says the recommendation isn't the end of the discussion.
It would be our responsibility to define what significant fiscal or regulatory impact is, not just use those words. I think we would really need to get into that.
Democrats also disagreed with recommendations that would direct state courts not to give state agencies deference when reviewing agency decisions. Nikki Kelly, is the legislature turning itself into a big administrative agency?
I mean, maybe. I mean, they do have to walk a fine line, but since they're only here 3 to 4 months a year, on how much pre-approval they need to be giving to rules and stuff. At the same time, someone mentioning separation of powers, we do have to remember that agencies have rulemaking authority because lawmakers gave it to them. Mm-hmm. So what they giveth, they can taketh away. And I think that's where they're going.
This is a question I keep coming back to, because we've talked about the issue that clearly Republicans, not all Republicans, but a lot of Republicans at the state legislature, have become increasingly uncomfortable with agency rules and regulations and fines that they've been giving out to businesses, for the most part. Republicans have been in control of state agencies for 2 decades now. Is this Republicans run amok? Is that what the legislature is saying?
So are they mad at each other is what you're asking me?
I guess.
They're controlling each other too much? Yeah, I don't know, but it definitely begs the question. And I do think in some ways it can become overreach, because it is Republican control and you're talking about Republican-run agencies. So then where is the disconnect? There seems to be some kind of disconnect. And I feel like legislators, they have enough on their plates to start worrying about rules and regulations in various agencies. So are we trying to now become a full-time legislature, or are we going to keep it part-time? I feel like they need to kind of go back to the scope of the job, maybe.
I do want to ask about we already saw, so they passed this major bill this past session. I said last year, it's still 2023. That took a long look at how agencies are allowed to make rules, emergency rules, and that sort of thing. And in the wake of that, I think it was the Department of Insurance came out and said, you've really messed with us, because we're working with insurance companies. The timelines you've given us don't work with that. None of this will work. That's understandable. There are unforeseen consequences. Aren't they just setting themselves up for more of those sorts of unforeseen consequences?
I think at the very basic level, Nikki's right. I mean, this authority exists because the legislature has, over years, and Congress has done the same thing, decided that they don't want to be involved in the nitty-gritty of administering the laws, the policies they set forth. So, for example, there's been times when legislators have had bills that have listed road projects. And they've been resistant to that and said, I think engineers at NDOT should decide what bridges we're fixing and what order, not the legislature. So here at NDOT, you get this authority to go do that. this process is always, whenever we enter these conversations, it's usually in reaction to what was broadly considered an overreach by an agency. And then the legislature reacts to that and pulls some of that back. So this isn't a new conversation. This is just this is what we're doing every year. They're putting forth policies and deciding who's actually going to administer this. Is it going to be IDEM or DNR? How detailed is the legislature going to direct them to get to an outcome that they want? Or are they going to give them the authority to go find it on their own?
I mean, so, to a certain extent, isn't it the experts who are at these, you hope are at these agencies, I guess? Mm-hmm. Aren't they the ones who should be deciding some of this?
Sure, and I also think we're kind of at an inflection point where over two decades of Republican supermajority or the majority being in power, we have seen kind of a slippery slope. I mean, the Department of Education, that used to be elected, and the legislature came in and made changes there. So I think we're kind of at an inflection point where our part-time legislature that prides itself generally for being a number of people who are part-time, come, for, a long session till April, a short session, which has turned into packing a long session into just a couple months. Those are grueling because of the capacity. So I think, we have these conversations, but it's coming to a point where we have to really consider, are we a part-time legislature? Or are we going to pack in a full-time legislature's job into just a couple months? And are we going to let the subject matter experts, to your point,
it's interesting, like this,
in the agencies kind of runs, do their job?
It runs directly contrary to what Houston and Bray have said, which is, we're not going to do very much. And it's like, okay, well, you're also considering the authority to do far more, or the necessity to do far more.
Yeah, not just the authority, but they would have to.
It becomes micromanging.
Yeah.
And you're
but that's just part of the balance. I think this is just what we're always doing. We're trying to figure out. It's the administration.
But is the balance falling out of balance?
We'll find out. I mean, we think the balance fell out of balance the other way, right? The agencies were overreaching, and now we're pulling it back. And it's a tug of war. Yeah. Right?
All right, Hoosiers are a step closer to finding out whether Indiana's abortion ban illegally clashes with the state's religious freedom guarantees. Attorneys for the state and a group of anonymous women argued over abortion and the state's Religious Freedom Restoration Act, or RFRA, before a panel of appeals court judges this week.
RFRA is a legal test. It says a state law can only substantially burden a person's exercise of their religious beliefs if the law is advancing a compelling interest and does so in the least restrictive way possible. Appeals court judges repeatedly asked Indiana Solicitor General James Barta how the state can have a compelling interest to ban abortion when it has exceptions to that ban, like for cases of rape or incest.
If this court looks more broadly to federal cases applying it, none of the cases have said simply because there's an exception, the state doesn't have a compelling interest.
ACLU of Indiana legal director Ken Falk, representing the anonymous women, was asked whether their religious exercise was really being burdened when none of the women are pregnant or seeking abortions.
It's the change in their sexual behavior. They have taken steps today solely because of the statute, solely because of their religious beliefs.
There is no timetable for the appeals court decision, and any ruling will almost certainly be appealed to the state Supreme Court.
Oshia Boyd, realistically, even if the abortion ban ultimately gets restrained under RFRA, it would only affect, for sure, this group of anonymous women. It was made a class action, so potentially more people. But really, will it change Hoosiers' access to abortion in this state?
I don't think so. For one, I think people now know abortion is illegal. I know we have certain exceptions, but I think for most people, they think abortion is illegal. Another reason, we now have limited access. So only hospitals and surgical centers can now perform abortions. We know there are no more abortion clinics that can perform abortions. So now there are also limited hospitals in certain areas. In certain rural areas, there are no hospitals. So therefore, you don't have access. So it even cuts down the access. So even if you can have an abortion for one of these reasons, you still may not be able to get to a place. And there are probably going to be parameters in with the time frame. So who's to say you can actually get there in that amount of time? So I think people will still, and it's just confusing, too. So I think people just still think, no, we can't have an abortion in Indiana.
Yeah, I mean, even if you have a hospital near you, almost none of them actually do perform abortions, will allow abortions to be performed anyway. So there's another lawsuit going on, which is a revisit of the first lawsuit, which is them trying to expand the medical exception, the life of the pregnant person, to add like mental health to it, and also get the abortion clinics to be able to operate again. Is that the one that really is going to, could be a game changer for access?
Yeah, I think before we move to that one, this one is probably a long shot, but even if they win, it affects a smaller number of people. The other one on access and what the exceptions are is the one that could actually make a difference. We reported, looking at numbers from the Department of Health for September and October, and under the exceptions, there were only 12 abortions in the state in September and 13 in October. And, you know, so that's showing you how few are happening. And in a few months, we'll get an updated report, and we'll see where. But they're probably all going to be in Indianapolis.
And in terms of, again, talking about the impact to people, even with this lawsuit potentially opening the door for more people to have access, if they can find somewhere to have access, it will be months, even theoretically years, before we get a final ruling in this case?
Yeah, and, you know, where's the who's the onus on to determine the religious exception? Most of the precedent we have this on comes from, like, the COVID vaccine.
Yeah.
At the bottom line is Indiana remains one of, if not the most restrictive state in the nation for abortion access, sadly.
All right, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Elise Schrock, Republican Mike O'Brien, O'Shea Boyd of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. You can find Indiana Week in Review's podcast and episodes at wfyi.org/IWIR or on the PBS app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.